Blog Talk Radio.
And don't take it for granted. I thank you for listening to what I have to say. I come here to this program, to this broadcast daily, to inform you. And I like to credentialize myself as an attorney that has been licensed now for, I think this last May, 35 years as a former judge. And let me tell you, a lot of the things that I talk about on this program, I have been in the legal field so long that it's pretty much automatic knowledge. Red flags go up. They may not for you because you're a lay person, or you may not be acquainted with the legal system, is what I want to say. Kind of stuttered there. But to those that are practitioners in the legal field, some of the things that we deal with or see on the news, we may not realize that there's some issues with the stories. There's always the behind-the-scenes legalities that we don't know about that may be causing a certain outcome or result. I'm thinking resort. Maybe I need to go to one. Result is what I'm trying to say to you today. I was just thinking on two cases today. I was looking in the news. One being the Jared guy. He was my hero, you know. I followed him, too, about Subway. So I always think of him, and I guess that's the point when you use a spokesperson like him, someone who successfully lost weight using Subway's product. But I was looking and reading his article today. I forgot what the news outlet, but I was really appalled. Well, I'll say surprised when I heard someone speaking on one of the morning shows saying that prosecutors have agreed. And I don't know. I was trying to determine if this is a state court criminal case for Jared or whether this is a federal case. With federal cases, it could be federal because of porn, transporting child porn from one state to another, or it could be confined to the state jurisdiction. But what I was concerned about when I heard the news is that his attorneys have entered into a plea deal. Okay, that's not the problem. But I heard that the prosecutors are going to agree to no more than 12 and a half years for this man, which is, to me, low. But then there is, and I like to tell the truth on this show. I want you to listen to the show. I want you to hear the balance of my views or opinions are balanced. I'm not going to just present one side. I also saw what I thought was a little skewed representations, because when you think about child, I was thinking minors. I mean, I was thinking, you know, 7 or 8 or something. However, when reading the article, I discovered that these children were 16 years of age. You know, 16 is the new 30. Not to justify it, but they were also apparently already working in prostitution. As opposed to the view that I got that these were some little children, you know, if you know what I mean. As a judge, that makes a difference to me. I mean, being a professional judge of situations, that makes a difference to me. That's a mitigating factor in my view. And maybe that's why he got that 12 and a half years. The other disturbing fact, and I say exceptional and unique, is that his lawyers agreed not to ask for less than 5 years. How is that? In pre-sentencing guidelines, I've never heard of such a thing. That was totally foreign to me to hear that a defense attorney agreed not to ask for less than 5 years. What kind of jurisdiction is that? Sentencing guidelines are usually prepared by a probation department, and they are separate from any input from a prosecutor or defense attorney. Normally, they court records and any input from the judge, very little though, and prepare an independent report that recommends a certain sentence to the sentencing guidelines to a judge. I've never heard of, maybe that was the agreement they made, that they were going to ask for more than 12 and a half years and no less than five years. I mean, hello? Very rarely have I heard of that agreement in allowing a defense attorney to have that strong of an input into the sentencing guidelines for a defendant. But he is a celebrity and apparently has received preferential treatment in the media. I just discovered that this case was at a plea stage, where a deal has been made. So I was wondering, with respect to the coverage, of what happened when he was arrested, what happened when they were going into the investigation. That wasn't publicized much, if at all. What happened when they began to, how did these complaints surface? Who knew and why and when? I mean, that's interesting to me. How come we didn't see media coverage in regard? And then was he arrested? Did he turn himself in? How come we don't know any of that? Is that something I'm missing in the media reports? Maybe I should look up more. But I always say that to highlight how political the media is and how selective the media is. I mean, we think that they're just there to report events as they transpire. That's not the truth. They're there to put a spin on events, to put a spin on information, and in some instances, outright lie. And what we have to do, what they should be doing, is that when they're given information, they should be returned to investigative reporting rather than accepting everything they see or hear. mostly what they hear from a third party regarding a news item. The media has become lazy in verifying facts and verifying events. Unfortunate, because then that lends itself to improper reporting. Well, I want to go back to my own case, about my case. I want to talk about this doctor, Dr. Norman Miller, that I never met, by the way. I don't even know him, never met him, never talked to him. This is the person that determined that I was too unfit to do my job. Well, you know, Dr. Miller is actually bordering on criminal behavior, criminal conduct. I understand, first of all, that the doctor was dismissed by Johns Hopkins University during his residency. So that suggests to me something is already wrong with Dr. Norman Miller. And what it is, I don't know. But why would the Judicial Tenure Commission and the Michigan Supreme Court defer to such a doctor? Perhaps they could not find anyone to make or render these very false and fraudulent opinions. But in any event, Dr. Norman Miller, as I've said it before on my Twitter page and Facebook page, a paid-for-hire expert, and basically paid to say something, whether it's based on real facts or not. Unfortunate, because that's the person that the Judicial Tenure Commission and the Michigan Supreme Court relied on to remove me, I mean, to lose my job when I was elected first-place judge for a second term by the voting electorate of the city of Detroit. And yet they allow such a doctor to make such a dire and impactful opinion based on nothing, based on all, very little. And I started to wonder, did this guy follow the protocol that one follows for a psychiatrist? I know, first of all, that I can't get any medicine without going to the doctor dead in the eyeballs, having him evaluate me, diagnose me, and then render an opinion, and then, of course, whatever the treatment is. And Dr. Miller is no different. However, a judicial entity, the Michigan Supreme Court and the Judicial Tenure Commission, allowed this man to get on the stand and testify about my mental health when he's never met me, and then render an opinion. Oh, you know, she's mentally unfit to do her job. You know, she can't read and write and analyze as I'm doing right now in the throes of your very ears here today. This man is criminal. Criminal behavior. I'm reviewing an article where the prosecution in a case on a serial murder case also questioned the credibility of Dr. Norman Miller. It's in the Abulassam case, Abulazam. In that case, that was a case out of trying to get the venue here, Genesee County, where this man had stabbed. He killed five of them and injured nine. Okay, so that's 14 people. What happened was he lured these people over a three-month period into a certain place where he began to stab them. And so he would set up these schemes to draw people to him, and then he killed them, or stabbed them, or attempted to kill them. And Dr. Miller testified in his case. After evaluating this person, testified in his case that he was mentally ill. Come on. And in that case, he received $6,000 to say he was mentally ill. And in fact, that was the attempt to get this young man off of, to separate this young man from being convicted of these crimes. Okay, that's essentially what it did in this criminal case. And I don't know what the outcome is. I guess I'm going to have to look that up. But the prosecution in that case indicated that they thought Dr. Norman Miller was questionable with his opinion. This is a person now that the Michigan Supreme Court relied on in removing me as a judge from the bench. And like I said before, he was also removed and dismissed from a very reputable hospital, Johns Hopkins University, during his residency. So there's problems with Dr. Miller, and yet this, a judicial entity, knowing the problems with Dr. Miller, in other words, this guy did not have an exemplary record, a highly reputable, highly acclaimed doctor. This was some, you know, quack doctor that nobody else wanted to be bothered with, and is paid a certain sum, just says anything. What does that make the Supreme Court of Michigan look like? What does that make the Judicial Tenure Commission look like? Does it sound like, you know, corruption to you again? And then I started to look at the clinical protocol for rendering a diagnosis. I'm tripping up on my tongue here. And I found some very, very interesting things. That a psychiatrist, and maybe this is why Dr. Miller was dismissed from Johns Hopkins, a very reputable, incredible institution that probably espouses adhering to very high standards in the medical practice field. And maybe Dr. Miller could not meet those standards, and therefore he could not continue in their service. Why am I saying that today? Because this doctor made a diagnosis of my mental health without ever meeting me, ever, ever, and without a history of my illnesses. He didn't have them because he didn't have my medical records. He only had a record of my knees, maybe an X-ray record of my knees. Other than that, this doctor was supposed to get the history of my illness, an illness that I had presently, if that was the reason. He was supposed to evaluate my history of my past psychiatric history, which I have had none ever in life. Never had anyone accuse me of being mentally unfit. And so you see the political implications here. And in 35 years, you know, I just got to be mental. Hello, having handled thousands and thousands and thousands, and I'll say it one more time, thousands of cases. Has there ever been a psychiatric hospitalization? Has there been a history of suicide attempts or aggressive behaviors? Are there past medical records available to consult? This is protocol now. These are the things Dr. Miller was supposed to look to. History of alcohol and drug abuse? How would he know that if he didn't talk to me? Tolerance or withdrawal symptoms. Has substance use been associated with psychiatric symptoms? Were there family members available who could provide corroborating information about the patient's substance use and its consequences? Well, they didn't talk to my family, even though they did. One of my family members did offer. Didn't talk to my family. They rather rely on some repo man that came upon my property to scare my sister and my family. And then he talked mostly to my sister, not to me. So he wasn't even knowing who he was observing. He goes into a court to say that it was me. I had a twin sister, almost identical. You don't know who you're talking about. So we have unfounded testimony in the case. We have a doctor that has ignored established protocol in rendering a diagnosis. That is, you have to evaluate somebody. You have to examine. You have to observe. He did nothing. He just rendered it off the top of his head. And it's improper and almost criminal I would say criminal. I'm going to be filing. In fact, I have filed a complaint against Dr. Norman Miller for his failure to adhere to doing his psychiatric evaluation and rendering an opinion. Isn't it criminal? You never met me. How are you going to render such an opinion? Dr. Miller was supposed to get a general medical history. He can't do that if he didn't talk to me or meet me. He was supposed to get a developmental, psychosocial, or social cultural history, such as what is all that? What is the patient's history of formal education? Is there a history of parental loss or divorce, physical, emotional, or sexual abuse or exposure to other traumatic experiences? What strategies for coping has the patient used successfully during times of stress or adversity? Now, how can he render such an opinion when he never interviewed me? Do you hear me, people? This is unheard of. Published in all the newspapers, oh, this judge has mental illness. Do you see the corruption in this kind of proceeding and the glaring abuse of process, that means abuse of the legal system, to accomplish what was accomplished? You used a quack doctor, a doctor that, look at some of these factors that he should have evaluated. What is the patient's history of formal education? What strategies did that? Okay. During childhood or adolescence, did the patient have risk factors for any mental disorders? What is the patient's sexual history, including sexual orientation, beliefs, and practices? Well, I can tell you that. I'm a woman, all woman, always been a woman, and always will be. God made me a woman. Does the patient have children? Well, no. You don't know anything, Dr. Miller. Never did. What is the patient's capacity for self-care? What are the patient's social-cultural supports? What are the patient's own interests, preferences, and values with respect to health care? What is the patient's occupation, and what jobs has the patient held? So you see, all of this, and I'm telling you, the questions that I'm looking at, basic protocol for evaluating conducting a clinical evaluation for a patient to determine the presence or lack of mental illness. I mean, these questions are going for 5 pages. So Dr. Miller and other factors, legal history, family history, review of systems, co-examination, mental status examination, all of these are functional assessments, diagnostic tests. And so all of these factors go in properly to making a proper psychiatric evaluation. None of this took place in my case. Dr. Miller did none of this. And I have filed a complaint with the American Medical Association to actually have Dr. Miller's medical license suspended or either taken away completely. Apparently, he's already had some problems in this criminal case where he ruled that person who was luring people to a certain spot to stab them was mentally ill. Instead of finding that this person was intentionally killing people, he is trying to say he was not criminally responsible and did say he was not criminally responsible for his actions, so that he can walk out the door and not be responsible. So we see the kind of history here with Dr. Miller. And then I don't even have to mention the attorneys that were so derelict in their duties to defend this type of testimony. I mean, they were virtually just malpractice everywhere. And I am prepared to file against them as well because they were poor lawyers, Cyril Hall and Kevin Ladler. And get the transcripts. Don't take my word for it. Get the transcripts of the proceeding to see what they did. I mean, this is the information in a newspaper article that anyone could have retrieved. Did they ask Dr. Miller about his dismissal from Johns Hopkins University? Did they ask for the reasons why? Did they ask Dr. Miller about the opinion that he rendered in the Abu Salem case? And did they ask Dr. Miller why he was rendering such an opinion of mental unfitness when he never met Judge Brenda K. Sanders? Did you review her Blog Talk Radio segment that she's had for over 3 years? Did you look at any, did you review the transcripts from the thousands of cases that she has presided in the 36th District Court, Dr. Miller? So you see what you have here, and I remind you almost every day that you're dealing with criminal elements there in Michigan and the capacity of the judicial system. Criminal elements. This is criminal. And so if you have corruption in that capacity in the judicial spaces in Michigan, in the judicial system, then you're going to get corrupt results. You're going to get corrupt decisions. And I'm sure you all, most of you already know it. But I'm reminding you again today, and this is wide open in the public for everyone to see. It is the tip of the iceberg. Let me say it again, the tip of the iceberg. All right, well, I guess that is the end of my thoughts for this program. I'm certainly going to be revisiting this issue again in a few weeks once I get some more information about Dr. Miller. So this is the kind of thing that goes on. This is a political hit using a quack doctor, a doctor that you would think that they would have used someone who is upstanding, someone that is very reputable. And no, they had to go to someone that's not very reputable and that his decisions and opinions are questioned even by prosecutors. Well, that is all I have. And if I were you, I'd be jumping mad and raving mad if you go to the voting booths and attempt to put a certain person in office and they are summarily removed by someone like Norman Miller. Well, that is all I have to say for this broadcast. I thank you again for listening. If you would like a copy of this broadcast or would like to hear an archive, broadcast of this episode, you may go to the link at blogtalkradio.com/setting-the-record-straight-2015. If you should have a comment, maybe you have some information about Dr. Norman Miller, question, input, a response to what I've said on this program today, you may email me at dks1233@outlook.com, and I will certainly return the email. And I just really invite you to do that at your convenience. And like I said, I stand ready and available to respond to your concerns. Thank you again for listening to the program. Have a blessed evening and talk to you tomorrow.